And good morning. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is time for Jaws of Justice Radio. And my name is Beth Pike. Welcome to Monday morning. Today, our host is going to be Robin Martinez. And Robin is from the local chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. And she's going to talk with Shahib Batar, who is director of the grassroots advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And they're going to talk about the intrusion of government and corporate actors in your line of communications and how it affects not only your privacy, but also our democracy as well. We'll also want you to stay tuned because in the middle of the show, we have our calendar of events. And then at the end of the show, it's the 420 Drug War News. But up next will be Robin Martinez and his guest, Shahib Batar.
Good morning. This is Robin Martinez. I'm an attorney in Kansas City with the Martinez Law Firm, and I'm a member of the National Lawyers Guild, the Kansas City chapter. Today, we are simultaneously doing our NLGKC podcast, which will be archived for the National Lawyers Guild KC chapter. And we're also on Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM Community Radio, Kansas City, Missouri. Today, we have a really good program. We are speaking with Shahib Batar, who is the Director of Grassroots Advocacy for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Shahib, welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Robin. I'm excited to be with you.
A lot of our listeners may not be aware of what the Electronic Frontier Foundation is, its work, and what it does. Can you tell us a little bit about EFF?
Absolutely. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, was founded in 1990 at the very dawn of the Internet age to essentially defend civil liberties online to make sure that technology would be a force for liberation instead of a force for domination. And the things that we do include impact litigation. For instance, we have several cases challenging the NSA Dragnet that collects more or less anything that goes over the Internet and a lot of telephone metadata, even from within the United States, in violation of the Fourth Amendment and statutory limits on the agency's powers. We also have a technology team that actually builds privacy-protecting software for free, not just in the sense that it's free to use, but it's free as in freedom, open-source tools that are user-empowering. And I can talk about some of those in a little bit. And then we have an activism team that also works to help inform and mobilize the public. And we do that across issues not only including privacy, but also individual security and access to the intellectual commons in the face of an intellectual property regime that increasingly favors corporations against innovators and against consumers and the public.
That is a tremendously broad range of issues. I mean, it seems like it implicates everything from First Amendment free speech issues to privacy, transparency, and even fair use under the copyright rules. Is that fair?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're really committed to the idea that culture is shared among people, and the Internet is a tool that can empower culture, or as it has increasingly become, it can be a tool to essentially pad the pockets of corporate rights holders. And protecting fair use, for instance, to ensure that people can maintain access to protected works for the purposes, for instance, of satire or political commentary is really vital not only to the rights of the people who want to make those comments, but also to our culture. And that's ultimately what we are defending, is the viability of culture online and the opportunity for everyday people to participate and be a part of it.
Now, you indicated the EFF has been around for quite some time. Who were some of the folks involved in getting it started?
Yeah, you know, our founders are a really prolific and innovative bunch of people. This was really the first wave of tech entrepreneurs. One of our founders, for instance, Mitch Caper, is the founder of Lotus Notes, the business spreadsheet that preceded Microsoft Excel, is the one that everybody used. He's someone who was very early on in the Internet wave and the technology revolution, and he saw the writing on the wall. Another of our founders, John Perry Gilmore, is a cultural luminary. He not only wrote the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, but also was a lyricist for the Grateful Dead. Another of our founders, John Gilmore, was one of the very earliest employees at Sun Microsystems and has been a very prolific advocate, not only for digital freedoms, but other issues as well. And it was early on when the Internet was very young that these folks came together and recognized that this new forum that they'd helped create was under threat, both by government and by major corporations. And EFF was founded to try to preserve the constitutional legacy that the founders of our country created in this new space that was emerging that since then has become increasingly central to all of our lives. You're right that the issues that we work on increasingly cut across different spheres. It's harder and harder these days to find a policy arena that is not touched by technology. And particularly because the technology can be novel and presents sometimes well-established questions in new ways, it's important to have a voice addressing those new arenas and those new issues, and we're proud to play a role in those debates. I mean, just to add a couple examples, when the FBI took on Apple and tried to force a major company to hack its users, we were there to defend encryption and the opportunity for device manufacturers to protect their users without being compelled by the government to undermine their users' security. When a gaming company in Austin, Texas was raided as part of a computer crime ring, supposedly because people associated with it had been caught essentially gaining access to government websites, we were there to defend those individuals, and we've defended fair use, we've defended privacy, we do it in the courts, we do it online using technology as a backstop, essentially recognizing that if the law can't protect us, the technology can. And we try to get ahead of the debate as well by fighting these battles in the press and in Congress and even in state legislatures and city councils increasingly across the country.
Now, you mentioned a case involving a gaming company down in Texas. Was that the Steve Jackson Games case?
You got it. That's exactly right.
Yeah, that was a number of years ago, but it was quite a famous case. What were some of the issues that were involved in that?
You know, the Steve Jackson raids were before my time at EFF, but I'll do my best job that I can at addressing it. This was a case that basically pitted not even an online gaming company. Steve Jackson Games makes board games, essentially, and they were sued by the U.S. Secret Service, and the case was ultimately decided in Steve Jackson Games' favor. And what it essentially addressed was the access, if I'm not mistaken, to computers.
Yeah, that access is a hot topic these days, given what a lot of people see as the overbreadth of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Would that be a fair statement?
That's exactly right. This presaged the CFAA, which had not yet become law at the time. But this really related to the Secret Service's concern about the 9/11 system. And it was about essentially a copy of a telephone company document describing how the emergency 9/11 system worked. And the fact that there was an unauthorized copy of this document led the Secret Service to raid a board game company. And the fact that they were doing it because someone had copied that document online was one of the original cases that said to our organization's founders that there was a need for a new voice to protect these freedoms in this new space.
I could certainly see how that would make a lot of sense to the EFF. What now? Let me fast forward a little bit, and that was one of the early cases. But my understanding is that the EFF was also involved in litigating some of the illegal wiretapping cases that occurred during the Bush administration most recently.
That's right. Yeah, the first of our cases in that arena, Juul versus NSA, is actually still undergoing litigation. You know, it's been over a decade since we filed that case, and we are still awaiting a meaningful resolution on the merits of the substantive allegations that we raised. And, of course, in the years since then, a prolific government whistleblower, actually a contractor, Edward Snowden, released the documents that focused the whole world on the concerns that we had raised at the time. And in the wake of the Snowden revelations, we filed another similar case First Unitarian Church versus NSA, and while Jewell, the first of those cases, particularly addressed the Fourth Amendment issues at stake, that is to say the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, the First Unitarian case developed on the Jewell case by not only addressing Fourth Amendment privacy from searches and seizures issues, but also freedom of association issues that strike at the heart of the First Amendment. And notably, the plaintiffs in the First Unitarian case, there are almost two dozen of them, and they're organizations that span the political spectrum, from the Council of American Islamic Relations to the California Gun Owners Association. The named plaintiff is a church in Los Angeles that has long been very politically active. And it really, the assembly of plaintiffs not only shows how broad is the government dragnet and how broad are the spheres of Americans that share concerns about mass surveillance and the ways that it undermines freedom, but the case also very importantly suggests and connects the ways in which privacy is connected not only to the right to be free from searches and seizures, but also the opportunity to express yourself and to express yourself safely. The Supreme Court found in the 1960s in a series of cases addressing the NAACP in particular that the right of association included in the First Amendment includes a right of anonymity to anonymous participation in organizations. And it makes sense why, because in the 1960s, if you were an NAACP supporter in many parts of the South and that information were public, that would be enough to leave one very unsafe. And based on that precedent, at First Unitarian, we are championing both the right to be free from unreasonable searches as well as seizures, both of which happen constantly, not en masse, within the United States, and snaring innocent people who have done nothing wrong, people who even the government would concede have done nothing wrong. But it also, in addition to that, undermines First Amendment principles that keep us free as a society. And we're very concerned about that entire spectrum of issues. And while we are continuing to fight those battles in the courts, we are also very actively working with Congress to try to ensure that there might be a modicum of legislative independence, the checks and balances that have been so absent since the Bush administration, quite frankly, and including and going through the Obama administration, really encouraging Congress to fulfill its constitutional role of also checking and balancing the executive branch.
Let's delve into that issue here in a moment, along with the Fourth Amendment search and seizure issues. But before we do that, let me go ahead and just for our listeners, we're speaking today with Shahid Buttar, who's the Director of Grassroots Advocacy with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Shahid, you touched on the issue of search and seizure and the Fourth Amendment rights. There was I'm sure you're familiar with a recent Supreme Court case, Riley versus California, that really, I think, at least in my estimation reading the case, was a strong stand on the part of the Supreme Court towards digital privacy. Was EFF involved in that in any way, or I'm presuming you've done some advocacy around those issues?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe we wrote an amicus brief in the case, though it also preceded my time, and I'd need to confirm that. I can figure that out while we're talking. But Riley was a seminal case that essentially established that when arresting someone, police officers don't have a right, unless they get a warrant, to search a cell phone. And there have been cases, for instance, where police would arrest someone. For instance, this was a case in Virginia, the name of which escapes me, but I think this was 2007 or 2008, police in Virginia arrest someone for a DUI, and without having a warrant, search the cell phone. And what they find on the cell phone are naked pictures of this person's girlfriend. And so they call all the cops at the station to start looking at these pictures and then start sending the pictures around to each other. And ultimately, this person who was charged legitimately with a DUI lost their job as a public school teacher, not because of the DUI, but because there were all these pictures of him and his girlfriend that were circulated, and they never asked for them to be circulated. The police had no legitimate reason to even look at those pictures, let alone share them, but because there hadn't been a clearly established limit on police power at the time, the department escaped any accountability. And so Riley was really important not only for defending the privacy rights at stake, but also for ensuring the police don't abuse people in the way that they have historically relentlessly, using technology as a point of vulnerability.
I think a lot of our listeners and a lot of people in the community are very well aware of the abuses that have occurred on the part of police and to a large degree, the lack of accountability for that. But let me segue to sort of a different question. One of the reasons I wanted to talk with you today, Shahid, was that you have been involved in helping put on a course on behalf of or to train activists in sort of digital surveillance self-defense. Tell us a little bit about that program.
Surveillance self-defense is basically an effort that we've undertaken to try to train social movement activists as well as vulnerable communities of any kind into how to protect your own privacy. And a lot of times, you know, people think of surveillance as only implicating, for instance, the National Security Agency. But the fact of the matter is that we are surveilled in the United States by any number of actors, not just the NSA, but the FBI too. For instance, the FBI queries backdoor searches of NSA-collected intelligence routinely about Americans in violation of constitutional and statutory limits on the agency's powers. Similarly, local police departments are very engaged in monitoring Americans, including people who have done nothing wrong. And if you expand the context beyond government, it's also the case that people are increasingly subjected to corporate surveillance, particularly when you use tools online that purport to be free. And so tools that don't cost something to use often have a hidden cost, and that cost is surveillance by a corporation that will take the data supplied by a user and then monetize it, use it usually to enhance their advertising offerings to advertisers.
Can you give us some examples of that? The first one that obviously comes to mind is Facebook, for instance.
Right. That's the quintessential one. But, you know, any number of people use free email platforms online. And so when Google tracks your browsing history to serve you targeted ads, you know, it's free to use Gmail and it's free to search on Google, but Google is still making a buck off of you by selling your data essentially to advertisers. And those are advertisers of any conceivable kind. And so you could construe not only is Google surveilling you too, but if the advertisers are effectively in order to serve their ads to the people who they think they will be most interesting to. And beyond corporations, it's also worth noting, and you know, the tools that we train in the surveillance self-defense courses can also insulate people from surveillance by, for instance, their employers, or alternatively their friends, or perhaps their family members. And privacy is a human right. And technology, again, can be a tool that can either eviscerate that privacy and leave our private lives and our innermost thoughts exposed to the world to see, or if used, and I don't want to say necessarily thoughtfully, but with a little bit of training, which we try to supply, technology can be very empowering. And if you think about the ways, you know, one of the very immediate use cases that comes to my mind in the context of the surveillance self-defense tools are opportunities for peaceful activists in the movement for Black Lives to protect their communications from police departments that have proven themselves very insensitive to rights as basic as the right to life of people in the movement who are responding to a disturbing series of violent incidents, you know, the latest of which involved a police officer shooting a health care worker and then who was lying on the ground hurting no one, and then when asked why he shot them, saying, "I don't know." You know, when people are being shot in the street for reasons that we don't know and being spied on when they peaceably assemble as constitutionally invited to do, to petition their governments, our governments, for the redress of their grievances, giving those movements and those activists tools to ensure the integrity of their own communications, which includes not only their privacy as well as their security, but also the opportunity for them to engage their First Amendment rights is very important to us. And I would love, if possible here, just to dive into one aspect of their First Amendment rights or anyone's First Amendment rights that often gets lost in conversations about surveillance and privacy, which is that, you know, the right to speak or the right to assemble or the right to press, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, these aren't just rights that exist for the sake of the people who use them. Right, they are individual rights, but they're individual rights that were constructed to protect democracy. And whether or not, for instance, one of your listeners might support the movement for Black Lives, it's not even necessarily the case that by defending the rights of those communities, we defend the rights of the speakers. We also defend our own rights to hear. And that's one of the issues at stake here. You know, when people think about the chilling effects of surveillance, the tendency of people to silence themselves when they know that they're being watched, oftentimes in light of our government's well-established history of going after social movements and using surveillance not to enhance public security, but instead to marginalize particular political perspectives or social groups, the opportunity to defend the rights of those movements and social groups is one that defends not only their rights, but also all of our rights, both to be free from similar abuses, but also just to hear those groups and take their concerns into account as we pursue our democratic governance.
Those are tremendously salient points, given what we are dealing with today in terms of the increased number of groups that are engaged in the public sphere and are engaged in protest. Has the EFF collected any data that, or is there any data out there that you're aware of that could demonstrate how pervasive surveillance of activist communities and activist movements is?
So the problem at the moment, of course, is that it's hard to isolate that because literally everyone is being watched. Now, it used to be the case that in order to attract the FBI's attention, you had to have an opinion. And if you had an opinion, that made you a target of government surveillance. And for 40 years, that was true from at least from the 1940s after the close of the Second World War until at least the 1970s. And I could make a case for examples in the 80s and 90s when this continued. It didn't really matter what you believed. As long as you believed anything, the FBI was after you. If you were a Puerto Rican who was interested in independence for your country, the territory of Puerto Rico, that made you a target. If you were a black person concerned with the right to vote, that made you a target. If you were a woman interested in equal pay for your work, that made you a target. If you were an armed service member concerned with peace and not being deployed to senseless conflicts, that made you a target. If you were a college student and you didn't want to get drafted to go to a war that was based on a lie, that made you a target. And that was the case before. And the problem, of course, now, there are two big problems. The first is that government surveillance generally is hidden behind a veil of secrecy that is generally impenetrable. We're very excited that in the Juul case, the first of the cases I mentioned challenging the contemporary NSA, National Security Agency, Dragnet, we recently gained an order from a federal judge for discovery, meaning the NSA is being forced to turn over documents about its surveillance activities to a group outside the government for, as far as we know, the first time since this constitutional crisis started. So the veil of secrecy and cracking that veil of secrecy to gain access to the facts is one problem. And just to be clear, it's not just civil society that suffers this problem. Courts and Congress are also blind to the facts, yet making decisions based on their affirmative ignorance. So Congress, despite having asked, for instance, how many Americans have been monitored, Congress has never been given an answer to that question. In fact, the first time somebody asked that question of the Director of National Intelligence, what they were told was an outright lie under oath that was contradicted flatly by documents revealed by Edward Snowden 3 months later. And those officials happen still to serve in the Obama administration. The other problem here, beyond the veil of secrecy, is the ubiquity of the surveillance. And it's not merely the case that individuals or even organizations or, for that matter, movements are spied on anymore. The NSA is monitoring the Internet and the phone system, which ensnares effectively all Americans. And so isolating who or how many people have been monitored is, quite frankly, a Sisyphean task that knows no limit. And while we're very excited about the discovery order in the Juul case and finding out a little bit more about what's happening in the surveillance arena, at the moment, very few details are known.
Okay, it is time to break right now for the Jaws of Justice Radio calendar. You are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM, community radio in Kansas City, Missouri. We will be back in a moment.
Now, the calendar for July 25th. The Cross Border Network monthly meeting will be Monday, July 25th. Their board meeting will be at 6:30 p.m., and the membership meeting with the public invited at 7:30 p.m. at the KCK South Library in Argentine, 3104 Strong Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. Then, on Tuesday, July 26th, the Cross Border Network and Progressive Youth Organization are sponsoring a showing of the movie the true cost, about the clothes we wear, the people who make them, and the impact the industry is having on our world. This event is open to the public and will be shown at 7 p.m. at the Plaza Library, 4801 Main Street, KCMO. Corey's Network Incorporated will be gathering to recognize the third anniversary of Corey Lakovich's unsolved murder. They will do so by releasing balloons, praying together, and lighting candles. You can join them Saturday, July 30th, starting at 8 p.m. They will be gathering about 3 blocks west of the Independence Mall on the corner of 39th and Cracker Neck Road, Independence, Missouri. The NAACP Kansas City, Missouri branch July General Membership Meeting will be Tuesday, July 26th at 6:30 p.m. at the Brush Creek Community Center, located at Cleveland Avenue and Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard, KCMO. This meeting will include a candidate forum beginning at 7 p.m. with candidates for the office of Jackson County Sheriff, and at 7:45 p.m. with the candidates for the 23rd House District and the 27th House District. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. That's kkfi.org. Tune in next week when host Keith Brown-Ill talks with Melvin Merritt about his Penny Mill event, and host Latara Smith talks with family members of the wrongfully convicted. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Now we are going back to Robin and his guest, Shahib Buttar, Director of Grassroots Advocacy at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Okay, we are back again. Shahib, right before our break, you were discussing the ubiquity of surveillance and the degree and just the tremendous volume of all of the data being collected on each and every single one of us in this country. And you mentioned the veil of secrecy that shrouds what is generally known and what's generally available. But that veil was lifted a little bit with the revelation that were brought to the light by Edward Snowden. What exactly for me, you know, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are aware of what Mr. Snowden revealed, but what's the significance of that? And to what depth did the documents that Mr. Snowden revealed show that we are being subjected to ever increasing amounts of surveillance?
Great questions. So let's start with going backward. With respect to the documents, a lot of people saw essentially isolated stories about particular documents. For instance, the document from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that authorized the NSA to collect the business records of thousands of Verizon business customers in a single order, or perhaps the X Key Score program that allows, it's basically like Google for intelligence analysts, right, where they can enter any email address or search identifier and isolate a particular individual, or the PRISM program, which allows for internet spying, or the upstream collection program, which is like the sieve through which everything goes on its way to being filtered. But to zoom back from the individual disclosures, I think there are a couple things that are especially worth noting. The first is that we don't know how big the iceberg is. Even the Snowden revelations were the tip of an iceberg, and we should realize that by now they're a three-year-old tip of the iceberg. The iceberg was never revealed, and astonishingly, to my continuing chagrin, Congress has proven profoundly uninterested in figuring out what the iceberg looks like. You would think if Congress were informed by a whistleblower that the executive agencies that it was inviting to testify in hearings were lying, in those hearings, you would think that Congress might go to the whistleblowers and say, okay, well, tell us what we're not hearing. But despite there having been half a dozen NSA whistleblowers to come forward over the last decade, Snowden was not the first, though he did have the most documents. In fact, I think he was the only one, as far as we know, who brought documents to the fore, which is why he's now abroad, since he can't get a fair trial in the United States. You know, Mark Klein had come forward in 2005, William Binney had come forward, Thomas Drake had come forward. All of them said there is a huge constitutional problem here, and Congress has asked none of them for the facts that they can't get from the executive officials who lie under oath when asked direct questions.
Why do you think that's the case, Shahid? I mean, it seems that Congress obviously has an oversight role. Is there any inclination or is there any kind of information out there as to why they are abdicating their role?
You know, there are members of Congress who've done the right thing here. Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon comes to mind. He's a Democrat. His counterpart, Senator Mike Lee from Utah, a Republican. Similarly, they have tried to get some insight here in the House as well. There was recently just a Fourth Amendment bipartisan caucus launched in the House just a week ago, and the 20 members of it, including Representative Zoe Lofgren from California, a Democrat, or Thomas Massey, a Republican from Kentucky, or Justin Amash, a Republican from Michigan, who's been very active in this arena, they all have been trying to get to the bottom of this. Even the author of the Patriot Act, Republican Representative James Sensenbrenner, at one time chair of the House Judiciary Committee, he has been aghast in the wake of the Snowden revelations at the ways in which a tool that he says he crafted trying to give the government investigatory powers to keep us safe has been twisted into a tool to essentially conduct thought surveillance. And I want to come back to that and what surveillance means to freedom of thought. But these people have sought the information that has been kept from them. Congress is a body of 530 people, and for better or worse, the leadership of each of the major parties in Congress has been thoroughly co-opted, essentially, by the party leaderships of each of the last two administrations. Under the Bush administration, Republicans were predictably complicit in Congress in allowing the executive branch, led by their party leader, to grow beyond its limits. And since President Obama came into office, Democrats have been defending the Bush administration's signature initiative. They're carrying the Bush administration's water because it's the Obama administration now holding the glass.
And hasn't the Obama administration prosecuted more whistleblowers than any other administration?
Yeah, in fact, it is fair to say that not only that, the Obama administration has prosecuted more national security whistleblowers under the Espionage Act. These are people, conscientious government servants, who've given up their careers to do the right thing and alert the American people to the ways our resources are being used to undermine our own rights. These are people who are the quintessence of public servants. And they have been vilified under and prosecuted under an act reserved for spies more times under the Obama administration than in the entire 225-year preceding history of our republic combined. And for this administration to claim transparency as one of its values when it is conducting a vicious and relentless witch hunt targeting whistleblowers, I think, is both hypocritical, very disturbing, portends very dangerous, because if you can get away with that while claiming transparency, what might an administration do that is renowned for not being particularly transparent? And, you know, without naming any names, it is safe to say that both of the candidates for the next election, neither of them are particularly renowned for their transparency. So it does portend very, very terrifying things, I dare say, for the future. Lots of things happen in secret, like torture, like, you know, fake justifications for armed conflicts. These are the kinds of reasons that the founders of our country set up a robust system of checks and balances. And when you ask me, why is Congress not getting to the bottom of the story that it has gotten glimpses into, I think one of the reasons is quite frankly the partisan allegiance of congressional leaders to administrations in the White House that have come each of the major parties and agreed in essentially increasing executive power. You know, one thing you can say, regardless of the ideological interests of a president, is that there is a set of institutional interests in the White House, regardless of the party. And so the executive branch will always seek to aggrandize itself, which is why the founders of our country created courts and Congress to try to check and balance them. Madison talked in the Federalist number 10 about the dangers that factions present. It's one reason why we have a separation of powers, both across an executive, judicial, and legislative system, and across different layers of federal governments. So we have the federal government, we have state governments, we have local governments. So there's many different branches and divisions within government that are supposed to balance each other. And the emergence of political parties and the partisan fidelity to presidents of different parties who have shared this agenda of aggrandizing the executive branch, either because they want power or because they don't want to be blamed for the next terror attack, or because, and this is the kicker, I think no president has adequately appreciated the ways in which surveillance can kill democracy. And with your permission, I want to just dig in on that. A lot of people I hear every day, somebody claim that they have nothing to fear from surveillance because they themselves have nothing to hide. And the first thing I think those people forget is history. Because in the United States, surveillance has always been politicized. U.S. history is replete with examples of targeted surveillance to undermine particular social groups. So if you're aware of that history, you would know that whether or not you have anything to hide, you have a great deal to fear. In fact, the people in our country who've had the most to fear in the past have had nothing to hide. One of them in particular is a national hero to whom we name a national holiday. There is a statue and an entire memorial to the good Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., in Washington, D.C., and he was the target not only of FBI surveillance, but a secret campaign to drive him to suicide. And that's not a conspiracy theory. That's acknowledged in Senate documents after the Senate conducted a two-year investigation in 1976, the likes of which Congress has never even considered seriously since, even though, quite frankly, what Snowden brought to Congress and the public was a much more damning record than what activists who broke into an FBI office in 1971 brought to members of Congress who then convened the Church and the Pike Committees, the precursors to the current intelligence committees that have grown so co-opted. So history is one issue here, but the last point I want to make with respect to the freedom of thought is that surveillance not only chills people and drives them to censor themselves, but in driving them to censor themselves, will prohibit and effectively undermine the ability of people who don't censor themselves to hear all perspectives, right? It is a democracy-killing initiative. You might describe, in fact, always, mass surveillance has always been known around the world as a defining cornerstone of authoritarianism for a reason. And to sing anthems about living in a land of the free and a home of the brave in a country that, quite frankly, is neither of those things, I think is disturbing, and the ways in which surveillance undermines those very crucial values that have undergirded not just the constitutional design, but the very ethos of our country, I think should alarm anyone, whether or not you have an opinion that would put you in particular at risk.
Those are incredibly good points. But let me dig a little bit into maybe some of the technical details.
Sure.
We all know that Edward Snowden's revelation showed that the NSA is, in effect, collecting all of our data over the telephone, no doubt over the internet, all of our emails, all of our phone calls, all of our text messages. How do they do that? What are the mechanics of that?
So what Mark Klein revealed, he was the first of the NSA whistleblowers, in 2005 were signal splitters at AT&T switching facilities in San Francisco. So in the phone metadata context, the agency splits the signal and just routes a copy of everything through its own servers, right? The voice network is increasingly, I believe, in fact, at this point, entirely run over data, so it's all converted, and the NSA keeps a copy of it. In the context of the internet spying, it's not very different. Basically, anything that is transmitted over the internet, the NSA has a chance to see. And I want to zoom in on your point about the word collect. According to a normal definition of the word collect, yes, the agency collects everything and then decides later what might be interesting to it. And that's one place at which an unconstitutional seizure happens. The agencies claim that it's not collection until somebody looks at it, which, of course, is preposterous because it turns the word collect on its head. And it also is very presumptuous with respect to the agency's powers. But the NSA has very sophisticated technology. In fact, some of the strongest in the world. Among the other things it did is intercept Cisco shipments of routers to then engineer vulnerabilities into those routers. This is basically, you know, routers are the backbone of the internet. And so the NSA basically, you might say, bugged the switching stations that make the internet work surreptitiously, even over the objections and without the approval of the device manufacturers or the people who had bought these devices and were installing them to enable their own networks. The agency has hacked the internet actively for the last 15 years and increasingly turned it from a tool that could be liberatory and access point to information, to inspiration, to creativity, and turn the internet into a mechanism to spy on the world, including Americans, without any reason.
Now, that has to be a tremendous amount of data. And I think we all know, just based on our own individual computer use, limitations of storage and processing power. Is there any reliable estimate as to the actual volume of data that's being collected and stored?
3 years ago, at the point of the Snowden revelations, the NSA was collecting 1.7 billion electronic intercepts every day, and their capacity has likely grown since then.
How can they analyze all of that data?
Well, that's exactly one of the problems. In fact, for 10 years, the FBI has been saying, we can't assess all this. I think the first news story I saw about this might have been in 2007 or 8, that the FBI was actually complaining that the NSA was generating too many false leads. And of course they would, right? I mean, if you're tapping the internet, anytime somebody uses a word of potential interest or, you know, maybe has a satirical snide comment in an email, you know, for that to trigger government scrutiny, of course, is silly in the first instance. But, you know, one of the things you're hitting at here is that it doesn't even serve a security purpose. There's another way of rationalizing this or looking at it, which is to say, if mass surveillance worked to actually keep us safe, there wouldn't have been a mass shooting in Orlando. There wouldn't have been a terror attack in San Bernardino. There wouldn't have been a bombing in Boston. You know, these attacks and the fact that they happen and succeed demonstrate conclusively that these powers not only make us not free, but they don't keep us safe either. And in fact, the simple fact of the matter is there is not any capacity to meaningfully analyze all of the data that the government is collecting about us. In some cases, quite frankly, the government doesn't even pretend to. For instance, at some points in the past, we don't know necessarily if this is still the case because encryption is becoming so widely available, but at some points in time, the agencies treated anyone who used encryption, that is to say mathematical algorithms to guard the security and privacy of their communications, that anyone who used encryption was immediately suspect. And that's preposterous. But what's interesting here from a security standpoint is that the agency can't read those communications yet. But because the NSA is constantly innovating at the boundaries of cryptology and quite frankly has some of the world's most sophisticated cryptography technology, their plan is to hold on to it, develop their tools, and then crack the encryption in the future to be able to read in the future what it can't read today, which is to say there is no conceivable security purpose for that information in the current time slice, yet still it's been subjected to pervasive collection.
That has to eat a tremendous amount of storage space to hold on to that volume of data.
The NSA has data storage on the order of Google or more. You know, there's a facility, one of their facilities in Utah alone consumes something on the order of 3 million gallons of water a day just to cool the servers, which are the size of stadiums. And some of the world's most sophisticated computing is being levered and used for precisely this purpose. You're right that it's gargantuan, and it's, you know, by extension, it is consuming vast, vast resources, not just money, but natural resources too. Don't forget, Utah is a desert, you know, the place in which all this water is being used. And those resources, as well as the constitutional harm, the lack of any demonstrated security rationale, these are all reasons that we're all very concerned about the continuing operation of these programs that should have been shut down a long time ago.
So what can protest movements and members of the activist community do realistically to protect themselves?
I often describe the surveillance state as a dragon, right? And, you know, in traditional folklore, dragons were very difficult beasts to combat. And just a few minutes ago, I was talking about how surveillance is effectuated not just by the NSA and not just by the FBI, but also by every state's highway patrol, every city's police department, every county sheriff's department. And while the NSA and the FBI might be very hard to take on, police departments are not. Police departments are very politically vulnerable, both because they effectively undermine everyone's rights, whether you're an African-American concerned about arbitrary and extrajudicial assassination in the street, or whether you're someone else who is merely concerned about the fact that your police department might be using a stingray device to tap the cell phone network in your town, or flying an aerial drone over your city to visually monitor you and your neighbors, or using automatic license plate readers to scan the license plates of every car in town, enabling real-time and retrospective location tracking. These are all constitutionally offensive, but the point is they're conducted by agencies that answer to Congress, but instead answer to city councils. And moving Congress is hard. There are 530 people. They represent all parts of the country. They can't agree on anything. The biggest city councils in the country are 50 people. And you, whereas that to a member of Congress, you might need 1,000 people supporting you or a bunch of money to find your way in the door. That's not true for city council people. They tend to be very unsupported. They don't have staffs or aides, oftentimes, to screen out the public. And so picking off the scales of the dragon one scale at a time is the name of the game. At EFF, we just recently launched a network, a grassroots network called the Electronic Front Alliance. And the alliance is composed of student groups, of community organizations, hacker spaces, everyday people who are concerned about these issues, not just surveillance, but also access to the intellectual commons in the face of the intellectual property regime that increasingly create walls off our culture's content, like film and video and music, behind the controlling walls of corporate rights holders. The Electronic Frontier Alliance network exists basically to inform each other and the public, which isn't necessarily hearing about these issues from mass media, and not only to inform people, but also to mobilize, particularly in engaging these kinds of local and state opportunities. The state law is a very vitally under-recognized resource, and in California, where I live, the state legislature just last year adopted the California Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which for the first time in the country requires law enforcement agencies in California, if they want to, for instance, search your email account, to get a warrant first. Just like in Riley versus California, the case that you mentioned that the Supreme Court decided a few years ago, the Supreme Court said that if police want a cell phone to arrest, they need to have a warrant first. None of these reforms should be particularly controversial. You know, a warrant requirement doesn't particularly constrain police. All it says is, if you want to search someone or a device, go ask a judge first. That's not a high bar to hurdle. If they have any conceivable purpose or reason, most judges will sign the warrant. The only thing a warrant requirement does is ensure some legitimacy in the operation of the monitoring. It stops police and intelligence agencies from conducting fishing expeditions, or what you might describe as ambient surveillance, just subjecting the country to monitoring for no particular reason.
So the takeaway there, Shahid, is that, you know, to quote the, I think the words of the former Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, all politics is local, and that local politics and state politics perhaps provides a tremendous leverage point that community organizations and activists can use to try to fight back against digital surveillance.
That's exactly right.
We've got a wrap here, but where could folks in the community go to get more information about the EFF's work and even, you know, maybe some of the digital toolkits that you might have available and tools to help people protect their privacy?
Sure. You can visit us online. EFF's website is EFF.org. Very easy to remember. The two particular sites on our website that I note for your listeners, one is the Surveillance Self-Defense site, which is, I believe it's just SSD, Surveillance Self-Defense, .EFF.org. Actually, I think it's EFF.SSD.org. And then the Frontier Alliance is EFF.org/EFA. The Electronic Frontier Alliance. So Surveillance Self-Defense, the Electronic Frontier Alliance, both on EFF.org, can be great resources, and I would really encourage any of your listeners concerned about these issues to get in touch with us and let us connect you to allies around the country who share your concerns and are taking action every day to build the movement for digital rights.
This has been a fantastic conversation. This is Robin Martinez. I'm an attorney in Kansas City with the KC chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. You've been listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM, community radio in Kansas City. We've been speaking with Shahid Buttar, who is with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Shahid, thank you so much for your time today. We'd love to have you back on another occasion. This has been a great conversation, a lot of food for thought, and hopefully some very actionable things that our listeners and members of the community can do to help themselves. Appreciate
your
time.
You're very kind, Robin. Thanks so much for having me.
It's the 420 Drug War News, and as a sign that the times they are a-changin', here comes the following from a couple of local lawyers.
Hi, I'm Will Hudson.
And I'm Chris Harris. You know, kids, if you're in possession of less than 2 ounces of marijuana in the state of Texas, that is a Class B misdemeanor.
Unless you make the really stupid decision to try to either alter, destroy, or conceal your weed while you're standing next to a police officer. Don't do that. Then it becomes the third-degree felony of tampering with evidence.
We wrote a song to help you remember this. Don't eat your weed.
Moving down the road, you're driving pretty slow, 'cause you've got some marijuana on you. You really love pot, and it's not a whole lot, just an ounce or maybe two. Oh, red and blues, flashing in the rear. To the shoulder. No, please don't eat your weed. It's only a Class B misdemeanor. You get a little manic and then you start to panic, 'cause you've never been in trouble before. Officer approaches, you try to eat your roaches, and you throw your weed out the door. Oh no, the cop sees you, 'cause that's what he's trained to do. Now you're in big trouble. No, please don't eat your weed, 'cause it's only a Class B. Lots of other ways to plead. It's just a misdemeanor.
My advice has always been never carry more than you can eat. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
We hope you've enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and the guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, or its staff and volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio page on Facebook. If you have a show idea or you want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website at kkfi.org. This is your engineer for Jaws of Justice Radio, Beth Pike. And be sure to tune in Thursday mornings at 6 a.m. when I host the Thirsty Thursday edition of your Morning Buzz. Our outro music is Better Man, and that's from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Khadija and the White Guy at 9 a.m. on Thursdays, and then Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 on Fridays. Up next is Beautician's Blues. That's with Luscious Lynn. And then at noon, it's Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. You'll want to stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon, and then Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo en Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.